Village and Hopewell Gardens. Do all the things you wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 1-800-441-4410 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to Season 2 of FW Presents Mountain Comics. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is my show where I talk about the comic books that I bought while on vacation with my parents in the Poconos from in the 70s and 1980s. And this is the first episode of Season 2. This was a show that I feel like isn't appropriate to do in the winter months, but now we're headed back into spring. It's Memorial Day, and so the show is back. So thanks, everybody, for the kind words, and everybody's really excited for the show to pick back up again. And I'm excited to start talking about these books again because I love these comics so much. And so joining me in this first episode of Season 2 is the man, the myth, the jacket, Derek William Crabb. Hi, Derek.
Hey, man. It's great to be here. I'm thrilled to be on Mountain Comics. This is a great show, and I like reliving your nostalgic trips back to the Poconos in the form of comics. This is awesome.
Well, thank you so much. You said I was really looking forward to this one. This book that we're going to be talking about is not a comic. Well, it is a comic book. It's pictures, but it's a paperback. It's called Captain America Battles Baron Blood. And I'll get into the history of where exactly I purchased this while I was in the Poconos. I keep calling them the mountains. That was my go-to term for them, the mountains. But it's really, to be precise, the Poconos. Now, Derek, you didn't have this book as a paperback. Did you have these comics at any point?
You know how I came to it was the Warren Remembrance trade paperback that came out in 1990. So, and I think I eventually, I liked these issues so much, I went back and bought the originals because, like, sometimes I would buy trades and I'd be like, great, I have the story, and that was the end of it. But I think this was one of those things where I dug all the Byrne and Roger Stern stuff so much that I went back and bought the original floppies later. But the first time I read it was in it's got a really nice kind of panoramic cover, I guess, that goes on both sides and everything. But that's how I first read the story. And I know you said you were reading the Marvel Illustrated book, which I don't have to, like, I kind of discovered that based on our kind of discourse over this episode, because I was like, oh, I didn't know there was Captain America Battles Baron Blood, like, Marvel Illustrated book. So that's new to me.
Yeah, I bought this book. This book went on sale in May of 1982. It was part of Marvel's line of Marvel Illustrated books. And I'll get into the history of those in just a second. But I bought it at one of the newsstands that I frequented. Probably the number one newsstand that I bought stuff at, because it was the closest one to our cabin. It was the one that I always bugged my dad the most to take me to. They had a great selection of comics. They would have these wire racks mounted to one of the side walls, and it was like the comics were like 10 books high, two rows across. So I mean, it was like I had to like stand up on my tippy toes to reach like the top books. And then one day I was in there, and I noticed at the very, very top, even on top of the comics, were paperbacks. That's where they always would put, you know, paperback books. And of course, as a kid, I ignored most of those because I was like, well, you know, whatever, I want to read comics. But then I saw this thing, this beautiful painted cover of Captain America fighting like some sort of vampire guy. I'm like, what is this? So I pull it down, and I looked inside that it was a reprint. I didn't know it at the time, but it was three Captain America comics collected in this paperback book. And it just looked so cool. The cover is so wonderful that I bought it, even though it was like $1.75, which at a time when comics were 50 cents, that's, you know, it's like four comics worth, but it just looked so cool. I couldn't say no. So I bought it and I took it back to the cabin. And I remember I just dove into this thing. It reprints Captain America numbers 250, 253, and 254. And as you mentioned, it's from the Roger Stern, John Byrne, and Joseph Rubinstein era of Captain America. And man, did they have a knock on this character. I mean, this run of Captain America, this and then leading into the James DeMatteis era, which followed it, are some of the best Marvel comics ever done, and some of the best Captain Americas ever done. I mean, they were outstanding. And so the idea that they would reprint these three great books in this little paperback, I just poured over it panel by panel. I loved every bit about it. And on the cover is a painted cover by Bob Larkin, who did a lot of the Marvel magazine covers. And it's a gloss on the cover to Captain America number 254, which was by John Byrne and Joseph Rubinstein. So it's his version of that. And it's got Captain America kind of prostrate on the ground as he's fighting off this vampire Baron Blood type creature. And The Marvel Illustrated books were a series of paperbacks that Marvel released around 1981, 1982, where they were just reprints of various comics from the Marvel history. And they did a lot more than I thought they did. I found a page about them. And around this time, they put out Blade Runner, Conan the Barbarian, the movie, a couple of Star Wars, Star Trek, Avengers, The Origin of the Vision, Daredevil, The Man Without Fear, Crystar, The Origin of Crystar, The Crystal Warrior, Fantastic Four, The X-Men, Dragon Slayer, The Incredible Hulk, and then two Spider-Man. So this was actually a fairly extensive line. I have not read any of these except for the Star Wars one, the Star Wars movie adaptation. But this was Marvel's attempt to kind of like, you know, get their books in trade paperback form. So they were really kind of pioneering this format. And it's an awkward format because, of course, the pages weren't built to be published the way they are, so they have to like literally take each panel and kind of rearrange it on the page, which of course throws off the design if the artist is composing a page. But it works for what it works for the sort of the hinky format that you've got going in these books. I mean, the artwork is in black and white, of course, so there's the color is missing. But none of that stuff bothered me. I love these stories so much that it just didn't bother me. And even though I have the comics, like you, I have the floppies, and I certainly enjoy them. I tend to go back and read the paperback edition just because it's like it warms all my, you know, all the nostalgia feels get going when I read and look at this thing again.
You know what's funny? Because I was going to ask you about that because I wasn't sure, because I don't have too many Marvel Illustrated books, but the one I do have in front of me here that I'm flipping through as we speak is the Return of the Jedi one. And that one actually, it's like, it's got the little logo on it, like the old 60s Spider-Man TV show where it's like in full color. And like that one actually is in color. And I mean, it's the same format that you're describing where they kind of go panel by panel mostly. But all the panels are actually colored. Cause I do have, I think like Justin gave me this, but there's another one I have. It's not a Marvel Illustrated book, but I guess it's published by Tor. But it's kind of the similar format where it reprints a bunch of issues of, I think, I want to say this is like Tales to Astonish, Incredible Hulk stuff, but it's all in, you know, black and white and everything, but with the same kind of format. So, I mean, I have some familiarity with the format, but like I said, I never actually saw the one with the Barb Lock and cover and everything, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, I have one of the Incredible Hulk paperback compilations. Again, I think it is by Tor. I bought it at a Scholastic book sale in grade school, and it is one of my favorite comics I've ever owned. And I'll have to do an episode on that because it was it reprints, as you mentioned, the Tales to Astonish stories, and it is like it's a trade paperback because it reprints like 10 issues of Tales to Astonish back in all in a row, and I absolutely love that book. So yeah, Marvel really, they really tried between they never really did the digests, but they certainly did treasuries and they did these paperbacks and they did black and white magazines. So they were trying all different ways to get these books out there. And so this Cap paperback came out in May of 1982, but yet we were on vacation in August of 1982. So this thing sat in this newsstand for over 3 months. I guess the newsstand was like, until we sell it, it's staying there. So, okay, you know, and they finally moved it when I bought it. And I said, this is such a good collection. So, as I mentioned, the story in question are from Captain America numbers 250, 253, and 254. And 253 and 54 are parts one and two of a story. 250 is a one-off, and that story is called Cap for President. And as I mentioned, it's by Roger Stern, Don Perlin, Roger McKenzie, John Byrne, and Joseph Rubinstein. Captain America stops terrorists from blowing up the new populist party's convention and meets Sam Underwood, the convention's chairman. Sam and his staff try to convince Cap to run for president. Cap declines at first, but agrees to think about it when pressed. When he returns home, Steve and his friend Josh help their mutual friend Bernie move into her new apartment until another friend arrives with a copy of the Daily Globe, which declares Cap will be running for president. Steve is surprised to find that his friends think it's a great idea. Cap then arrives at Avengers Mansion to find it besieged by reporters. Inside the mansion, Jarvis gives Cap telegrams to both the Democratic and Republican parties, asking Cap to represent them. Beast offers to be his campaign manager. Iron Man warns Cap of the red tape he'll get caught up in. Wasp says he's a candidate the public could trust, but the Vision points out that Cap is unqualified. Cap considers his position and calls a press conference. He explains his duty to uphold the American dream, but being president of the United States would require him to preserve the reality of the country. Since the two objectives are at odds, Cap must decline the presidency. or the candidacy, I should say. So it said, this is, I've mentioned in episodes of Film and Water and other places where when you have a premise that you that the reader or the viewer already knows is not going to happen, I think it undercuts the drama, kind of like Star Trek V, you know, where it's like the crew of the Enterprise is going to search for God. And you're like, well, they're never going to find God, so why am I watching this story? You know going into this story that Cap is not going to run for president. And I think they were smart in that they kept it to just one issue. But even though you know Cap is not going to run for president, this story works really, really well.
Yeah, it's a good book. And I like how it touches on all the different characters in the Marvel Universe. Like, I think my favorite part is when Robbie's kind of poking fun at J. Jonah because he's kind of like, hey, you know, if Cap runs, you know, like, what else could happen? And he's like, maybe even Spider-Man will run for mayor. J. Jonah's just like, what? So, like, yeah, it's a funny, I mean, there's good bits in like that, and they touch on, like, you know, different people's reactions to it. Like, I like how it covers, you know, Dum-Dum and Nick Fury and Daredevil and Spider-Man and Doctor Strange all kind of reacting to the news and everything like that. And so in that sense, like you said, yeah, you know, it's not going to be a reality for this particular comic. It's just going to be something that they kind of explore for the moment, but it is fun to have those moments where everybody's kind of in that consideration phase. You know, it's kind of a fun thing to do.
Yeah, and I love the scene in the Avengers Mansion, and I love the way Byrne does the panel layouts where it's the same shot of Cap as he's looking at the camera, and we just see all the different Avengers behind him offering their opinions. I love all that stuff. I think that's great. Yeah. And you can picture, like, the Avengers react how you would expect. Beast is all for it. Wasp loves Captain America and knows what a good man he is and thinks he would do it. And Iron Man is like, you know, he doesn't want to get involved. He's like, oh my God, the red tape you're going to have to deal with. And then the Vision is more clear-eyed where he's just like, you're unqualified, that you have no, you know. I love all that stuff. And yeah, I love seeing all the different Avengers reacting. Like, I like the idea that across the Marvel Universe, they all read the daily paper. Like, that's a fun idea. They're all, like, picking up the New York Times and catching up with it. I just, yeah, I think it's really terrific. And I love the final panel of just, like, the campaign signs left on the floor of people as they get disappointed and wander off. I just think it's terrific. It's kind of interesting is that, you know, the Marvel Universe, I don't know, from my knowledge, they didn't get that into, like, that the Marvel characters were in the real universe. They didn't. I mean, you know, occasionally, I mean, famously, Captain America met Richard Nixon early on and stuff like that. But, like, for the most part, they kind of stayed away from that because, of course, why would the Republican Party in 1982 pursue Captain America as a candidate? They already had a president who was going to run for re-election. They wouldn't need a new candidate. But they just kind of ignore that. Like, it's just like, no, in this sort of parallel universe, Cap could be the nominee for either one of the parties. I just think it's a very kind of mature take on a complicated subject for, you know, a superhero comic book. I think it's like a very, like, sober, clear-eyed view. All props to Roger Stern, who just wrote a terrific story.
I think it's a fine tightrope to walk, and I think this issue does it particularly well. I think sometimes there are instances where, like, Marvel does tackle it, and it feels like it's too current or relevant, and then when you go back and read it, it sort of dates it. So I'm kind of glad that we can come back to this and not like it seems like the people, the candidates are all kind of like made up governors and things like that. So it's like I just feel like that way I can kind of just take the story at its own merits and everything and not get caught up in any kind of machinations that existed in that day or maybe now, and then you can just kind of have a fun time reading the story and enjoying yourself. So that's why this story works for me more than maybe some other attempts that have been made to sort of, I guess, make things current and or relevant.
Yeah. It's just like, exactly. I'll need to add to that. That's perfect. By not giving all the details, it kind of just, and it works all the time. You said you read it now and it holds up just as well.
The idea of
like, because you could imagine, you know, if we lived in a world where there were superheroes running around, you could see someone wanting to make a popular superhero run for office. Because it's like, what a brand. You know, what a brand Captain America's got. So, and I mean, I think a lot of people would probably vote for Chris Evans for president now if he decided to run. So, you know, I could totally see that. It's just a really terrific story. And like I said, it's I love that they chose that one to reprint in this book. So
I think it's telling too how timeless this is, because this is 250 and they put it like in the story, like, you know, regardless of, you know, it, basically it's not like it just kind of flows in order. They didn't do 250, 251, 252, 253. Like, it seems like this had issue 250 and then they went into the Baron Blood story. So I feel like there's this was singled out and isolated for a reason, you know, mm-hmm. because of the done in one nature of it, because of the content and the quality, and also because of the sort of the timeless nature of it, because you can read it anytime and it's still, you know, I mean, as long as it's an election cycle, you know, like it has some kind of relevance to people in general, because they all kind of experience that, whether they're, you know, young, old, or, you know, hanging in there like me.
Yeah, I think Marvel recognized from the beginning that was a really great story, and so it deserved to another chance for people to read it and stuff. It's just terrific. So yeah, as you said, they jump ahead to Captain America number 253, which is part one of a two-part Baron Blood storyline. This first issue is called "Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot?" and again by Stern, Byrne, and Rubenstein. After finding a third slasher victim, an English village constable and Dr. Cromwell inform Lady Crichton, who promises to use her influence to get Scotland Yard involved. However, doubting they can handle the situation, her elderly father prepares to contact someone who can. In Manhattan, after attending a musical together, Steve Rogers and Bernie Rosenthal return to Steve's apartment, but their liaison is interrupted by a phone call from Jarvis, who reads Steve a coded telegram, prompting him to cut the date short to Bernie's dismay. Traveling to England, Steve reunites with Lady Crichton, formerly his invader's teammate Spitfire, and learns it was her father, Lord Fallsworth, also known as World War I's Union Jack, who sent for him, convinced the slasher is their old foe, Baron Blood, despite his remains being long interred in the Tower of London. Investigating, Captain America discovers a woman's skeleton has been swapped for Blood's. He returns to the manor to inform Fallsworth of this and meets Jackie's son Ken and his friend Joey. That night, Baron Blood attacks Captain America. You know, man, this is one of those things where you think Captain America doesn't work in kind of like a dark... This feels like a Batman story. And you wouldn't necessarily think Captain America would work in this story. But holy crap, does it. I mean, I love this story to death. This is so much fun. And I love Roger Stern working in the invaders to this. And get I think this thing is like flawless.
I particularly enjoy the tie-ins because I'm not... You know, what's funny about it is what I realized is I'm not as familiar with the invaders as some of my other friends and everything. And I kind of realized like this is one of those stories that is good in and of itself, that everybody kind of keys in on it and likes it. So if they're, say, a fan of Captain America, you can read it and get a certain level of enjoyment out of it. But if you actually go back and kind of look at the history of Baron Blood and Spitfire and Union Jack and everything, like, it's expertly handled. Like, this is the kind of thing that I guess we all kind of dream about for modern comics, where you're like, why can't you have your cake and eat it too? You know, like, sort of have all the little continuity nods and everything kind of lines up just right and everything. And but also, at the same time, like, I didn't read Invader comics until maybe the last two or three years. Like, I mean, this was enough as it stood alone that I had a full kind of idea of what was going on. But then if you go back and read those stories, like those early, I think it's like Invaders, like 7, 8, 9 or whatever, where they first introduce Baron Blood, like this just, that adds a whole extra layer to these two issues. Like, you know, the way they're interacting with Jacqueline Crichton and everything and kind of seeing her. Like, I was going to ask you, like, have you ever read like the Roy Thomas Invaders? Like, was that something you got into when you were a kid? Or
I read some of them as a kid because the book just showed up very sparingly. You know, it just as the subject to the whims of newsstand distribution as I was, If I saw the book, I bought it because I liked all that kind of stuff. I liked that team. I had no idea reading this book in 1982. I had no idea that Baron Blood was like an older character. I mean, I don't think I might have even noticed in the little footnote that it was like, oh, from Invaders number 9. I thought he was like a creation of Roger Stern or whatever, and I didn't know. And then later on, when I went back and read some of the Invaders, like, oh, there's Baron Blood. Okay, they're using this character that was created just a couple of years ago. So yeah, you're right. This story, I think, works even if you've never read an Invaders comic, because it gives you all the details. You're like, oh, okay, we all know Cap fought in World War II. He fought with some other superheroes. Those heroes are now old, and they're now facing this, you know, undead villain who they thought they killed. Okay, works perfectly. You don't need to know any more than that. You don't need to have read an Invaders comic. I love the visualization. I guess that's really the work of Frank Robbins, who drew him in the Invaders. But I love that Baron Blood looks like Nosferatu. Like he looks kind of like almost like a rat creature, kind of.
Yeah.
He's sinewy and very unhuman looking, as opposed to, say, like Dracula, looks more like a human. So Burns' art is like mysterious, is like purposely moody and shadowy, perfect for a vampire type story. And again, you would not think a guy dressed like Captain America would fit in that milieu, and yet it does. I mean, it really captures that feeling of like this, you know, these sort of like these moors and everything is creepy and weird with these long dark shadows. And I love how it ends on a cliffhanger of Captain America's been hypnotized by Baron Blood and he's about to get his neck chomped on by Baron Blood as the other heroes watch helplessly. It's just like, I'm like, every time I read this comic, I'm like, God, this thing just works like gangbusters.
You know, it's funny reading it through this time, like the things that stood out to me were kind of funny, because I think we just started, I'm like, shameless plug, but we just started doing a Thunderbolts podcast. And what we do is discuss an issue of Thunderbolts and then discuss kind of a historical issue in the second half. And we were reading an old issue of Captain America where it introduced one of the Thunderbolts characters that was their first appearance. But it was funny because in that issue, it was like, I think 192, like we were all laughing because Captain America like sneaks, or he doesn't really sneak, but he boards the plane as Steve Rogers, but his shield is still strapped to his back under his shirt. And we're just kind of like, you know, how would anybody not notice that and all this other stuff? And I guess what stood out to me this time is this is like the mental correction of that, because he's got his Avengers priority card. So it's like, it's in his art profile portfolio bag, so it's not on his back, and then two, they don't like search that or anything or inspect it, because you know he basically flashes his priority badge and they're like, oh, you know, no problem, sir, like go right through, like anything you need and stuff. And so like I was reading it this time and I'm kind of like, oh, that totally, like, you know, that rectifies any problems we had with sort of the because comics rationale. Like it kind of wipes that out of your mind, because you're like, oh, cool, like this just, you know, it flows nicer, and you're not questioning like how does he bring his shield overseas without going through the metal detector or whatever kind of, you know, questions or doubts you have. And that's why I think you point to this and go, look, that's flawless, you know, because you're like, that's so awesome that it's like you don't even go there, you know. And you know, even though it's this fantastical thing, Or like you say, even though Captain America is kind of this four-color character, but you don't question that he's in this kind of almost moody, you know, Hammer horror setting with a Nosferatu-type vampire in the background and everything. And then the other thing that stood out to me this time, because I was thinking of Lady Crichton, you know, back when she was like young and vigorous and in World War II, and she was, you know, Spitfire, you know, she had the transfusion of blood from Jim Hammond and was a superhero. It was like in this, like she has those kind of self-doubts about, you know, how young Steve Rogers still looks. And she was younger than him when they first met. And now she's older than him. And I don't know if this inspired anything or not, but like, I couldn't help but think now of, I don't know if you've ever read it or not, but in John Byrne's She-Hulk run, he brought back this old Golden Age Timely character called the Blonde Phantom.
Oh, that's right.
And she was like this kind of vivacious kind of masked adventurer, and she was, you know, super beautiful and everything. And then, you know, when she shows up kind of as a sidekick of She-Hulk in that run, you know, the years have been, you know, they've taken their toll, and she's a bit more portly, and she's older, and all that kind of stuff, and just, you know, the nature of age. And so I think, you know, while Lady Crichton isn't as extreme in this instance as the Blonde Phantom was, you know, for the sake of probably, you know, comedic value in She-Hulk, like I did kind of think of that and went, wow, like they, you know, Spitfire and Blonde Phantom kind of have similar trajectories in the terms of this issue. And I was just kind of, you know, I guess those were the things I was sort of taking note of when I read this time.
Yeah, Stern manages to get in some nice characterization of the older characters. We got the notion that the older guy, the older Lord Fallsworth, like he is an old man now. I mean, he's like in his 80s and he's bound to a wheelchair, but yet he still kind of wants to be Union Jack. And they have to kind of be like, no, 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 like, you know, no, Grandpa, you can't do that, you know, like you're doing. And they have little traces of that, of where, how sort of envious they are of their friend, Captain America. And here he is looking vital and healthy. And, of course, as drawn by Byrne, you know, he's like huge, you know, he's got his muscly, and I mean, he's like a peak physical specimen. And here are these people having to deal with the fact that their friend, who they've known for 40 years ago, is you know, they've all aged and he has not. And I liked that they get those little moments. I think that's those are great little details. Again, Stern managed to these things are just plotted perfectly. I mean, really, really well done.
There was something else I wanted to ask, and I wasn't sure if this was something you'd noticed or not, since you read it, you know, first when you were a kid or whatever. But are you familiar with Captain America's friend Arnold Rothstein?
I'm a little bit, yeah.
Okay, so like I know like that to me, like because I remember when the first Avenger came out, I went and did this huge like read through of all the Captain America comics, and as I was doing it, you know, they introduced Arnold Rothstein, and then, you know, they had little subtle hints where, you know, he had a partner and he had a friend and all this other kind of stuff, and as I kept reading it, it finally clicked with me, and I went, oh, okay, I see what they're, you know, setting up and everything, and it was a little more obvious, I think, when like the Red Skull got involved and he was basically slandering all of Captain America's friends, you know, I think, right. He called, you know, Bernie the Jewess, and they called Arnold Rothstein, you know, the fop and everything, and then maybe it was a little more kind of obvious, but I didn't realize that when I was doing my read through at the time, and it kind of dawned on me, and I was starting to wonder if maybe like Roger Stern was kind of trying to set that up for Joey Chapman and Kenneth, like, because I don't think that anybody's ever done anything like that with them. But like, I was just like reading the dialogue, and it's like the way, you know, the way that Jacqueline talks to her son, she says, if you were going to bring your dot, 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 your friend home for the holidays, you might have at least given me some warning. And like, and we'll see later, like they wake up in the middle of the night and all this other kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, well, Joey's a light sleeper and stuff. And I was just kind of thinking, oh, hey, wait a minute. Like, you know, maybe they were more than just, you know, dot, dot, dot friends. But I wasn't sure if that was anything that ever dawned on you when you read this. And I pretty much, I was trying to read up on it. And I think nobody's ever done anything with that. Like, I think it kind of all went in a different direction. But because it seems like he ends up becoming like the next Baron Blood or something, I was like, okay. But anyway, I was just curious.
Yeah, during this run, again, this and the run that J.M. DeMatteis did and Mike Zeck did when they took over, there was lots of stuff in here about Captain America confronting homegrown bigotry. And, you know, that was a big deal to me when I was a kid, because, you know, you're looking to these characters as your heroes, and when they react a certain way, it kind of informs your reaction. And there's a scene in a later comic, and I don't remember whether it's a Roger Stern or a J.M. DeMatteis. I think it's DeMatteis. But there's a scene where, again, this is this whole era where Captain America was an artist, which is, like, not a great career for him to have in terms of deadlines while also being a superhero. But, you know, that's a particularly chained...
But he got to draw comics for Marvel.
Yeah. Talk about, you know, being chained to your desk. When do you have time to go off on missions? But there is some issue where Captain America is bringing his portfolio to some publisher, and the publisher gets like a phone call in the middle of the interview with Steve Rogers, and the guy's secretary says, somebody, you know, somebody Kriegstein or something like that is on the phone for you. And the publisher says, you tell that old Jew he has to wait. And he gets up and he looks, and Steve Rogers has stormed out. And Rogers says something like, I thought we dealt with people like you during World War II, and storms out. And it was like, that was a big – and the guy even says, like, World War II, that guy doesn't look old enough to be in World War II. But it, that stuff was really, like, significant to me, you know, because it was like, yeah, you know, it underscored the person that I – like, you know, a worldview that I supported of like, yeah, don't be like this. What's your problem? And so I like that idea that Captain America is still dealing with anti-Semitism and bigotry 40 years later, because we like to think that, oh, we've dealt with it, and we, of course, we all know that we have not. But I mean, that was big, you know. And I like the fact that the Marvel allowed the writers to go down that road in little bits and pieces in between, you know, Captain America taking on the Red Skull and taking on, you know, the Ameridroid and all these other crazy concepts. Yeah. But they found time for that to sort of reiterate Steve Rogers as a person and his moral beliefs. I liked all that stuff. So I thought it was terrific. These are just, this whole run of Captain America at this time is just really, really terrific. So
yeah, it's great.
So the part two of this story is called Blood on the Moors. Great name. Again, by Stern, Byrne, and Rubenstein. Now, Baron Blood tries to chomp into Captain America's neck, but he finds that his chainmail armor is too thick to pierce, and he almost practically breaks his little fangs off on him. So he failing to slay Captain America, Baron Blood flees as dawn breaks, returning to a nearby village where he dons his Dr. Cromwell disguise, and meets his first patient of the day, Jenny. As the day progresses, a hunt for blood throughout the surrounding villages draws a blank. Ken and Joey take a break from the search at the pub where Ken's girl Jenny works, but she faints while talking to them, and they find bite marks on her neck. In Brooklyn Heights, Bernie and Anna clean Steve's apartment. Bernie takes a message that Steve lost an art assignment. Lord Fallensworth, dressed as Union Jack, insists he will serve as bait to lure Blood, but suffers a heart attack while arguing with Cap and his daughter. They later call family doctor Dr. Cromwell to check on Lord Fallensworth. When they leave, Cromwell alone with Union Jack, Cromwell reveals himself to be Baron. Captain America joins the battle and is forced to decapitate the vampire. Joey reveals himself as the new Union Jack, and the group later burns Baron Blood's body. During the funeral, Lord Fallensworth passes on. Yeah, I mean, first of all, I love the cliffhanger, the idea that Baron Blood is about to chomp into Captain America's neck, and they use the chainmail armor as, like, it's so thick that his fangs can't pierce it. I thought that was a great detail. I love that Baron Blood talks about, like, how bad it tastes. Like, it's like, blah, blah, and he's, like, spitting it. Like, it tastes like, I imagine it tastes like if you lick a penny or something. It's just, like, really horrible. Yeah. Again, as good as part one is, part two is just as good. I love the idea, the reveal of Baron Blood, that we find out that it's the doctor the whole time. I think that's a great idea. The whole the girl with the passes out because she's got the bite marks in her neck is like right out of the classic Dracula movies. And I love that Captain America is forced to kill Baron Blood, but he does it forced to. He does not want to kill if he doesn't have to, but he's absolutely forced to because Baron Blood is just snarling like a crazy maniac. And I love how Byrne stages it all via silhouettes, that we see the guy watching Captain America, and we see Captain America bring the shield down, and it's all done in silhouettes, and you hear like the chuck, and then we see the skeleton of Baron Blood, and we see the head is separated. Just a great moment.
I feel like the Batman the Animated Series guys got a lot of use out of the whole silhouette thing not violent or whatever, like for terms of censors and stuff like that. It's like you can show a decapitation as long as it's in silhouette, like that's okay. But if they actually showed, like, you know, not from Union Jack's perspective, but if they actually showed it like straight up Captain America with the shield doing it, then they might not have gotten away with it, or it might not have been, you know, as subtle as they, you know, we're going for in that sequence. Like, I always point to stuff like, cause there's Cap 321 where he has to take care of one of those ultimatum guys. And then like, I'm an unabashed fan of Earth X, where he basically goes after this kind of, I don't know, the little kid kind of Red Skull or whatever. Mm-hmm. And basically, like, there again, he's sort of forced to, you know, because that little kid is mind controlling. He's kind of like a, I don't know, a snotty little Professor X kid, like, or kind of like the kid from like the Twilight Zone who makes everybody do stuff and stuff. Right. Like, so it's like he's ultimately like he's forced to like snap his neck and stuff like that. But like, I didn't think about it because I was even reading like those early Invaders with Baron Blood, and even in that he ends up taking like a plane up with Bucky, and they end up shooting down some other, you know, Axis planes and stuff. But even then, it's like, I think Bucky's kind of like, yeah, we got him, right, Cap? And he's kind of like, why are you not happy about that, Cap? And he's just kind of like, well, you know, I think he has some kind of internal monologue, like where he'll be like, oh, he'll understand one day, mm-hmm. you know, like that, you know, it's like, it's not like he regrets doing what he has to do, but he takes no pleasure.
Right.
In it.
Yeah.
It's not something he's gleeful about, right. You know, like it's just something that, you know, that needs to be done because of the scenario that they're in and because there's no other recourse or alternative. So like in that sense, I, you know, it's kind of like, I've always thought of Captain America as a soldier. So when I see those instances, you know, it's never to me, like that never has seemed out of character or anything, you know, and in this case, like I always kind of point to, it seems like the Baron Blood has that like get you out of jail card free thing with that too, because I always remember like, you know, those things where it's like, well, you know, somebody would say like, well, Batman doesn't kill people. And then it's like one of those things where you're like, well, he sure as hell impaled the hell out of that vampire Skeeter. But then most people were like, do vampires really count? Like they're undead. So you didn't really kill them. So it's like then Cap has that kind of get out of jail card free where he's just kind of like, he was undead. I didn't do anything.
And what are you going to do with the guy? I mean, he's, you know, he's this snarling rat creature that's going to just keep killing as long as he's around. I mean, what else are you faced with at this point?
Right,
come on.
Right,
yeah. But yeah, you're right. No, that's what I like about it, is that I don't mind Captain America having to make that. I mean, as we see him in the first movie, the first Avenger movie, shooting people left arm. He's killing Nazis. Of course, he's not going to be tying them up. He's going to kill them. But I like the idea he doesn't take pleasure in it. He doesn't want to do it. He's just forced to do it. And as I said, Stern managed to craft like a really good mystery story. I mean, when you go back and read it, you're kind of like, well, all right, the Doctor's Baron Blood. Okay, obviously, because he's kind of the extraneous character. But when I read it as a kid, I didn't see it coming. You know what I mean? Like, it was kind of like, okay, like it just works on me. And I still think it does. I just think it's a really well-crafted mystery story. But he also finds a way to make it a good Captain America story while fitting in all this Marvel history. It's like, to me, like he really manages to balance all that really well. And of course, it gets visually, it's just such a delight to look at, the way Byrne and Rubenstein do it. I love Baron Blood, the way he like is crawling on Captain America. Like he's like he's an insect. He's like literally got his hands and feet around Captain America's neck and torso. Like he's more than just a human villain. He's like this unholy thing. I just think it's just terrific. I like the Union Jack. We think that it's the old man is going to be Union Jack, and then that's a false reveal. I think that's all great. Again, it's just like, I know I'm looking at these stories through nostalgia glasses because I first read it when I was when I was 11, and I was up at the cabin, and I still have sense memories of sitting on the couch by the window with the lake right behind me and just reading this book over and over. But even from my adult eyes, I still think these stories just work perfectly.
Yeah, I think that this is one of those rare exceptions. I mean, yes, your love of these stories is fueled by your nostalgic memories, but I think there's a reason why these are officially classic Captain America stories. There's a reason why all this entire run was collected in a trade in 1990. There's a reason why they made the Marvel Illustrated book in 1982. Like, they knew these were good, solid, classic stories. And you know, I totally get what you're saying. Sometimes there's things where you love things out of, you know, nostalgic reasons, and you kind of go back and go, look, I fully admit and own up to the fact that the reason why I love this comic is purely based out of nostalgia. Like, it's not quite as great as anybody else thinks it is, but I think it's that great. But these books are not those. Like, I think these books are timeless and can be read and appreciated, you know, ad nauseum, regardless of any sense of kind of nostalgia or reminiscence. You know, like, it doesn't need the added, you know, kind of glean or veneer of nostalgia to appreciate them. Like they fully stand on their own as good, solid classic stories.
And they're for a collection, for a trade collection, they are three stories that are kind of atypical Captain America stories. When you think about it, you know, I mean, like if you're trying to sell something at a higher price point, which is, again, this thing was like $1.75, you're maybe trying to sell it to a slightly older audience. You're assuming that, you know, a little kid may not have $1.75 to spend on one book. So I like the idea that the three stories collected are somewhat atypical. I mean, one's just like a character piece. And then the other two is Captain America in a very, like, bloody horror mystery. You know, I could see Marvel saying, well, you know, we're going to do a Captain America trade. Let's have him fight the Red Skull. Let's do some of those stories. Like something much more superhero-y. But instead, these are three kind of like slightly off-brand Captain America stories. And so I really appreciate that. And so, yeah, I just think this is such a great book. I wish they had even done more of them. I wish I could also remember if that newsstand had other Marvel illustrated books, you know, Captain America was and always is my favorite Marvel character. So it doesn't surprise me that if they even had other ones, I would have bought this one. But yeah, I love this book to pieces, and I'm so glad that that it was still sitting on sale 3 months later.
That's awesome. That's great.
I was gonna just sit there collecting dust, and just like, well, we're going to do something with it. I'm not going to send it back to Marvel. So yeah, it's Captain America Battles Baron Blood. It's a great book. As Derek mentioned, it's been collected in other editions. So if you have not read these books from this era, from like Captain America through like the 240s through around the 280s, 290s, they are really, really good story. Marvel really had a handle on Captain America. So that's going to do it, I guess, for Captain America Battles Baron Blood. So, Derek, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was so exciting to talk about. I love for the fact that you changed your Skype avatar to Baron Blood, chopping down Captain America's thing. I'm looking at it as I'm talking.
Yeah, that's my thing. We like having Skype avatars that are topical for the topic at hand. But yeah, that's one of my things. But yeah, no, this is great fun, and I'm glad that I had a chance to talk with you about it. And this is kind of, I think these issues are the gift that keep giving, because you can talk about them any which way and come up with all kinds of new things to say about them. So I'm really pleased that I was able to join you again for Mountain Comics.
Awesome. So where can people find you on the internet?
If people are interested, I have my History of Comics on Film. It's a chronological covering of all the television and film properties that have been adapted into comic books. That's at hocof.blogspot.com. And if you dig podcasts, we have a whole bevy of podcasts, like the aforementioned Thunderbolts one, over at fanholespodcast.blogspot.com.
Awesome stuff. Everybody, if you have not been watching the History of Comics on Film, please do. They are amazing, and I cannot imagine the sheer workload that you have put on yourself to do. These things are – I started binge-watching them a while ago, and I watched all like 65 episodes in like 4 days or something.
Awesome.
I just went through one. They are so fun to watch. They are full of great details. You managed to find stuff I didn't know, which I didn't think was possible. I figured that I knew all this stuff, but I was like, well, I'll watch it anyway because it's fun to see it all collected. But you actually managed to find details. I was like, what? That's a thing? I didn't know that. So that was – they are
– I think that's part of the fun of working on the project, because you have those moments of self-discovery. Like I think if I hadn't done the Battle Fever J and Miss America type of topic, like I probably would have less Baron Blood knowledge than I do now, you know? So it's like all those things are kind of fun. You just see how everything kind of intermingles and ties together. And since we're obviously passionate about comics and everything, then that's part of the fun of it, is to not become kind of content with, oh, I know everything. It's like there's always going to be something new to learn and pass on and find out, because you're always stumbling into information like that. Like you with the Marvel Illustrated stuff. Like I had never heard of that, you know, Captain America Battles Baron Blood before. And even when people were talking about it, I was still in the mode to like, I know that. That's the Warren Remembrance trade. And then I was like, wait, no, it's something new, you know? So that stuff is always awesome.
Yeah, no, that series is just amazing. So everybody, if you have not watched any of them, go give them a chance. They're like little bite-sized videos, and they're just chock full of information and amazing graphics. And Derek does an amazing job with them. They're just fantastic. And I was fortunate; I got to play Richie Rich in one of the episodes, which was just a lot of fun. So anyway, thank you so much, Derek, for coming on. Everybody, thank you so much for all the kind words about Mountain Comics. Everybody was like kind of really disappointed at the end of last season when I said I was going to wrap the show up for the winter, which made me feel really good because it's like this show is so specific to my memories of being on vacation, and I didn't know whether it would necessarily translate. But of course, so many people have been grew up reading comics on vacation, they can just sort of transpose their own memory. So I'm happy to be happy that we got the summer is coming back just on that, but I'm happy to be doing Mountain Comics again. So I'm looking forward to doing season two. So this is a great way to start it off because like I said, I love this book. It is so much fun. And you can actually get this book like on Amazon from a used bookseller on eBay for pretty cheap. If you want to actually read it in this format, you can get it for like a couple of, $4 or $5. It's not hard to get. So I would recommend that too. So anyway, read these stories anyway you can. Derek, thank you so much for coming on. Everybody, past episodes of the show, Mountain Comics, are on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And of course, Mountain Comics doesn't have its own Twitter feed yet, but you can comment and stuff over at on Twitter at FW Podcast. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Derek and I are going to have some soda and look out over the lake as the sun goes down, and we will see you later. Bye.